of the president personally, and I discovered this kind of reporting on him, taking criticisms to the White House, they are ardently supporting him. And importantly, not just kind of lower level officials, really high ranking people like Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, and Vice President J.D. Vance are pushing Witkoff as an avatar almost of what they describe as a different kind of Trump foreign policy, saying we are promoting a foreign policy that will bring peace to the region. Really important to remember that foreign policy, of course, involves, as I said, continued pummeling of Gaza and huge weapons deals to regimes that have pursued huge wars. But it is one that isn't necessarily being driven by intense U.S. military entanglement, particularly with Israel. And I think that pattern will continue. You'll see that mostly play out in the next few weeks. I think there's a looming deadline and fight over Iran diplomacy, which Steve Witkoff, the president's envoy, is also leading. Again, very controversial for Israel, very controversial for national security hawks. I think there'll be a really intense kind of battle over what Witkoff is willing to do with Iran.
And Akbar, I wanted to follow that up on Iran. The willingness of President Trump to engage in negotiations over uranium enrichment with Iran. I'm sure that Netanyahu and the current Israeli government is not happy with this.
They're certainly not thrilled, Juan. Their preference would have been for a U.S. and Israeli-backed military strike by now, in fact, prior to now. Their argument is we as Israel, in this kind of post-October 7th moment in our retaliatory campaign across the region, have weakened Iran, right? They've weakened the pro-Iran militia in Lebanon, Hezbollah. They've, in fact, even weakened Iran's own air defenses. So the argument from Netanyahu and his government is, let us use this moment to take a strike against Iran, knock it out for good. The counter-argument to that is, of course, unintended consequences of a major war, and also that technical nuclear expertise doesn't go away. So the Trump administration is saying, let's try to reach a deal, and they have stuck by that despite facing criticism. What's kind of unclear still is how much expertise they'll develop. These are very hard deals to negotiate. It's worth remembering President Trump is in this situation because he abandoned the deal that the Obama administration had achieved, right, through extreme negotiation and technical expertise. The Trump team hasn't yet shown they kind of have that level of professionalism, and also they haven't really made clear how much they're willing to give up to Iran. Iran, given that it felt burned by the U.S., which did abandon the previous nuclear deal, which Iran was complying with, Iran has said, we want a little more. We want more guarantees to know this will be permanent. This will bring us the sanctions relief in exchange for nuclear limitations. And I think the Trump administration needs to kind of demonstrate that, especially in the weeks ahead. There is a looming deadline again because there are U.N. sanctions on Iran that will go back into place starting in July. So if there isn't some kind of temporary deal by then, all of this diplomacy by the Trump administration will get much, much harder and less likely to deliver.
So continuing on Iran, Sarah Lewitson, a few days ago, this whole idea being floated, this is a piece from The New York Times, can Trump rename the Persian Gulf? His suggestion to call the body of water the Arabian Gulf has apparently done the impossible, unite Iranians. But if you can talk further about what this means for U.S. Iran relations, but then also let's go back to Qatar and talk more about what exactly Qatar wants at this point. I wanted to bring in that clip. It's like 3 seconds of Trump defending taking that $400 million flying palace. This is what he said to a reporter.
It's not a gift to me. It's a gift to the Department of Defense.
It's not a gift to me. It's a gift to the Department of Defense. And of course, when he leaves, it's going to go to him or to go to the Trump Presidential Library, which means the U.S. will pour in hundreds of millions of dollars to refurbish it. But then it goes to Trump, and these new Boeing planes supposedly will be the new U.S. Air Force One. But what Qatar wants from this? And so first Iran, then Qatar.
Well, with Iran, obviously, President Trump made clear, even when he was a candidate, that his goal was to reach a deal with Iran. And he even talked about lifting sanctions on Iran, which, interestingly, Kamala Harris criticized and condemned. So I think Trump has made clear his willingness to engage in negotiations with Iran to lift sanctions, to reach a nuclear deal from the get-go. I think Israel assumed they would be able to curb that and instead get war on Iran. That's failed. Very interestingly, Iran has just proposed a joint nuclear development, uranium enrichment with the UAE and with Saudi Arabia, something that would have been unthinkable, but would certainly sweeten the consideration of what could be a civilian power, nuclear power for the entire region, and brings these countries closer together. And I think that's a good thing. Anything that reduces the temperature of war in this region is a good thing. In terms of Qatar, Qatar depends on the United States for military protection. This $400 million plane is protection money, and it's directly protection money to Trump. But I don't think, even though the glaring flying machine that is an advertisement for Qatar is particularly glaring, I don't think we can take it out of the context of massive foreign influence, expanding foreign influence, the purchase of influence with money, with Gulf money. We have long had a U.S. foreign policy that has been controlled by money, including in particular pro-Israel money that has seeped into American politics, Democrats and Republicans. And now the Gulf states are in on the game more crudely and nakedly than ever before, as this plane signifies. And they're certainly outspending AIPAC, which is something that's making AIPAC and the pro-Israel supporters panic. But this, I think, represents the most glaring example of what has become the corruption of the U.S. political system, not just by domestic lobbying interests, but by foreign lobbying interests. So I think, in fact, all of this is quite depressing and disheartening because they are predicated on short-term gains, short-term financial gains, not just for President Trump, but for the entire establishment.
And Sarah, I wanted to ask you about Saudi Arabia. In a departure from his previous stance, Trump has suggested that Saudi Arabia will join the so-called Abraham Accords and forge relations with Israel, quote, in its own time. The significance of this?
Well, the significance of this is that Trump has successfully de-linked both the development of a civilian nuclear plant as well as this new trade deal. And I'm expecting a defense agreement, a defense cooperation agreement that will come from any normalization with Israel, whereas Biden had suggested that all of these things would be dependent on Saudi Arabia normalizing with Israel. That's off the table. But it's important to note that it's off the table because of Israel's own self-sabotage. It was really only Netanyahu and Israel who are the primary reasons there is no normalization with Saudi Arabia right now. And the Trump administration has now clearly indicated that they are going to proceed on their business arrangements and military arrangements with Saudi Arabia, regardless of its normalization with Israel. This is one of the greatest acts of political self-sabotage that we've seen in the region for a while, and it's pretty remarkable how close Israel was to normalizing with Saudi Arabia, but torpedoed that with its own fanatical, maniacal obsession with its genocide in Gaza.
President Trump, in talking to Bob Woodward, talked about how he saved the rhymes with glass of Mohammed bin Salman when it came to Khashoggi. You mentioned Khashoggi at the beginning, the founder of Dawn, your organization. But for people who may not remember what happened, if you can talk about that and the significance of Trump's very close relationship with the Crown Prince now, even as he said to Bob Woodward, I saved that, guys.
Well, that was a rare moment of clarity and honesty from President Trump, telling us, letting us know how he saved Mohammed bin Salman from global accountability, from judicial accountability, from complete ostracism with his crime that shook the world, which was the targeted kidnapping and assassination of a U.S. resident, Jamal Khashoggi, who had been writing critical columns about Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. In the Washington Post, but also founding and launching an organization that was aimed at reshaping U.S. policy with Saudi Arabia and the region, promoting democracy and human rights in the region. After this murder, I mean, we know that the CIA was surveilling the WhatsApp communications between Mohammed bin Salman and his primary henchman, Saud al-Qahtani, both before, during, and after the murder of Khashoggi at the Istanbul consulate, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and he was caught red-handed. The Biden administration revealed and released the CIA's assessment that, in fact, Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Khashoggi. But, of course, Biden capitulated on every front, going so far as to grant Mohammed bin Salman immunity from prosecution, though he is not the head of state of Saudi Arabia, because King Salman is still the head of state. So there was a complete pivot by the Biden administration, originally promising accountability for Saudi Arabia and then transforming into the fist bump and close ties with Saudi Arabia. So this is something that President Trump continues to have and hold over Mohammed bin Salman's head. They can release those messages showing Mohammed bin Salman's complicity in the murder of Khashoggi. I'm sure there are other secrets of Mohammed bin Salman's that the United States and the CIA has and will continue to lord over him. But right now, President Trump is focused on deal-making with Mohammed bin Salman.
Where is Khashoggi's body?
We don't know. One would think that at minimum...
killed in the Istanbul embassy.
Killed in the Istanbul embassy, reportedly either
of
burned.
Saudi Arabia.
The consulate of Saudi Arabia in Istanbul. Reportedly, his remains may have been disposed of in an incinerator at the premises or removed out of the premises and taken to a car wash to be disposed of. We don't really know. Saudi Arabia has never told us what they did with Jamal's remains. One would think they would have the dignity and respect to at least allow this man to have a proper burial, but that is not something we can hope for. And I want to remind people that Mohammed bin Salman may seem a little bit reasonable right now amidst the complete insanity of Israel in terms of the genocide in Gaza, but Mohammed bin Salman himself is a volatile, unpredictable, sociopath who continues to detain and imprison the mildest of critics in his country, who continued a seven-year senseless war in Yemen, resulting in over 300,000 deaths. And of course, not only did he murder Jamal Khashoggi in cold blood, but targeted and attempted to kill several other critics of his regime who live abroad, including in the United Kingdom, including in Canada, opening up really a field day of efforts of targeted assassinations.
And Sarah, I wanted to ask you, the prospect of a Saudi-U.S. security agreement with, as you mentioned, the leader that Saudi Arabia has right now, the Crown Prince, the significance of it, why does Saudi Arabia even need it, given the close alliance it already has with the U.S.?
Right. So Saudi Arabia has been demanding a bilateral security agreement, treaty-level guarantees and protection from the United States for a while, basically to immunize themselves from the herky-jerky of a new administration that comes in threatening to reshape its ties to Saudi Arabia. And remember, President Biden said he was going to cut all military sales to Saudi Arabia in the wake of its atrocities in Yemen and the murder of Khashoggi. So they want to immunize themselves from the back and forth of U.S. policy politics by having this defense agreement. Interestingly, the White House's announcement of its meetings in Saudi Arabia, the $600 billion in promised investments, which let's see whether or not they materialize and how quickly they materialize, had no mention of a security agreement, no mention of U.S. security commitments to Saudi Arabia. I'm pretty certain that these things are going to come. I don't think Saudi Arabia is going to allow the United States to develop this civilian nuclear plant for free. China has been willing to do it, and they've been willing to offer the deal to China. Saudi Arabia wants something back, and it remains what the United States has to offer it, which is military and political protection.
We just have 30 seconds, but Akbar Shahid Ahmed, I want to end where we started today's show with our headlines, and that is in Gaza, the horror that is taking place there, the intensification of Israel's attacks right now on Gaza, the starvation, the killings, the airstrikes, and you're writing a book on what's happened in Gaza. Your final thoughts on where this could all lead? I mean, if President Trump, I mean, the number of negotiations he's engaged with, coming to a ceasefire between India and Pakistan, with the Houthis recognizing Syria, if he stopped arms sales to Israel right now, there would have to be a ceasefire because Netanyahu could not proceed without those weapons.
I think, Amy, there's some hope of that, but fundamentally, I think it's so important to remember that President Trump has shown a really clear antipathy towards Palestinians fundamentally, right? These are not people who have something to offer him the same way that wealthy Gulf Arabs or others in the region do, or Iran, through a kind of preventing a war lens. So I think that while there's some hope and expectation of that, my conversations with people talking to the White House, hoping for something meaningful on Gaza, it's pretty low right now. I think there's a sense that there might be a fig leaf, something that says here's a U.S. plan to stop the fighting for a while. But that would really involve a really kind of pro-Israeli approach that humanitarian organizations are really worried about, would not necessarily help actual aid reach Gazans, and I think could very easily fall apart. So right now, there doesn't seem to be that interest and that deep expertise to deliver for Gaza, even though President Trump has this desire to be a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. But that may change, like everything in this administration, of course.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, HuffPost senior diplomatic correspondent, speaking to us from D.C. And thank you to Sarah Lee Whitson, the executive director of Dawn. When we come back, we go to a Salvadoran journalist who's had to flee El Salvador along with his other colleagues from the news outlet El Faro, after Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele threatened to arrest them for exposing how Bukele made secret deals with Salvadoran gangs. Stay with us.
Dijo Guevara el hermoso, viendo al África llorar en el imperio mañoso. Nunca se debe confiar, nunca se debe confiar. Guache legendario, como sembrando una flor al buen revolucionario, solo lo mueve el amor, solo lo mueve el amor.
That's Silvio Rodriguez performing in Central Park here in New York in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a journalist from El Salvador who's left the country, along with others, from the digital news outlet El Faro, after the Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, threatened to arrest them all. The outlet reported, quote, a reliable source in El Salvador told El Faro that the Bukele-controlled attorney general's office is preparing at least 7 arrest warrants for members of El Faro following the publication of an interview with 2 former leaders of the 18th Street Revolucionarios on Bukele's years-long relationship to gangs. Bukele has run the country under a so-called state of exception since 2022, supposedly in order to weaken these same gangs. And Salvadoran authorities have detained nearly 80,000 people accused of being in gangs, largely without access to due process. Human rights groups report at least 250 people have died in El Salvador prison since Bukele's so-called war on gangs began. This comes as Bukele is working closely with the Trump administration to jail immigrants sent from the United States at CECAT, El Salvador's notorious so-called terrorism confinement center, the mega prison. In a moment, we'll be joined by El Faro's digital editor in exile. But first, this is a clip from one of El Faro interviews with a gang member. In it, we hear how just 1 month into the state of exception, El Salvador back in 2022, despite having an arrest warrant being recognized as a clear leader of the 18th Street, Revolucionarios Charlie Cartagena was detained and then released after a mysterious phone call. This is Cartagena.
I'm telling you all this. That's a substation in Antiguo Cucatlan, so that's not a jail. You're really in there, and they had already taken my photo before. They were writing it up. I only heard when he told him, the manager there. Did you already post the news, he said? Not yet. I'm about to post it. Cancel it, he told him. Cancel it. Not right now. And they stood there. Why? And this and that. And he said, oh, well, those words are coming from up top. From up top? There's nothing we can do. And suddenly the call came in, man. I mean, the call came in and they just stared at me and said, take the handcuffs off him.
Under President Bukele, the fall of El Salvador's murder rate has been accompanied by a rise in forced disappearances. This point came up in El Faro's interview with a former Barrio 18 gang member who goes by Little Man, explaining how they carried out orders for handling murders allegedly under the direction of the chairman of Bukele's Social Fabric Reconstruction Unit.
What's that look, man? Gosh, talking to you about these points is very delicate, man, because it's like making myself worthy of something that maybe I do know, but I can't tell you because that's how it is. Do you understand me? I'm not going to tell you. There's never been a homicide, but I was said with Marroquín, if something is done without a body, there is no crime. That tells you everything. That tells you everything. Without a body, there is no crime.
No body, no crime. For more, we're joined now from an undisclosed location by Nelson Rauda Zabla, digital content editor for El Faro. Nelson, along with six other colleagues, faces potential arrest warrants for their reporting on Bukele's dealings with Salvadoran gangs. His new opinion piece for The New York Times is headlined, "The World is Finally Seeing How Dangerous Bukele Really Is." Nelson, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain why you and your colleagues have left El Salvador and the significance of this video that you released, what it says about the president of El Salvador.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you very much for having me. Well, you're talking about America's prime security consultant at the moment. The president Bukele is a man who says to be working for the security of Salvadoran people and has offered to solve the world security problems. Not long ago, he offered to lead a mission to Haiti, and he's selling the services because he supposedly has the solution for the world security problems. What we're doing is piercing that bubble. We're telling a story that's so different from that narrative, from the propaganda, because the man who says he has the solution for the gangs problem has actually made secret deals with him all throughout his rise through political offices, way before he was a president, but even now that he is a president. So, we're dealing with the consequences now. A Salvadoran prison is the last place that you want to be in. So I exited the country. I left El Salvador 1 day before the publication. And this is something that we have done routinely in El Faro to exit the country, not only us, but other journalists in El Salvador, leaving the country to wake for the retaliation or the consequences or the reaction of the government from afar, from a distance. So we left the country, and yeah, right now we don't know when we'll be able to come back. We don't know. We have our whole lives in El Salvador. We have families, and our job is there, in houses. But we're trying to make sure that we're safe first. And I think that's the significance, that we would not be facing this price if what we published was not as important as it is. It's telling the world that the president, who says he's the has the panacea for security, has actually been making secret deals with gangsters, with organizations that the U.S. considers terrorists. And when they tell it all, the videos have a great impact in Salvadoran society. They have over 1.5 million views in a country that's inhabited by 6 million people. This has really pierced through the bubble. We've seen analysis that says that more people saw the videos than people voted for the opposition in the last Salvadoran election. So that's the story we're telling, and we're grateful to be able to tell it, because American people should know that their government is doing dealings with someone who has been making deals with criminals.
And Nelson, it's not just your reporting on this, but back in 2021, the U.S. Treasury Department itself sanctioned two Bukele officials, accusing them both of negotiating with notorious local gangs in an attempt to seal a secret truce and shore up political support for Bukele. Can you talk about this, and who exactly is one of those officials, Carlos Marroquin, and his connection to the gangs and Bukele?
Carlos Marroquin is Bukele's designated man to deal with the gangs. He has done this job for Bukele before he was the president. He did it when he was running for San Salvador mayor, and he has stood throughout. But we found now that Carlos Marroquin, in at least two different cases, personally transported gang members with arrest orders to the border with Guatemala. And we know this because Carlos Marroquin confessed that in an audio that we published, an audio that he sent to a gang member and that we published back in 2021. So I think Bukele's negotiation with the deals is not something, it's not a reported story. It's a fact. It's a fact that's been proven not only by journalistic investigation like the one that we've made ourselves, not only by the U.S. authorities like the State Department and the Treasury Department sanctioning not only Marroquin, but also Osiris Luna, who is the director of prisons, and also proven by a Salvadoran criminal investigation that is now thwarted, because Bukele's party removed the attorney general that was investigating him and his party and his officials, put in place another one, the one that's made arrest warrants against us. So you're talking about a dictatorship, and you're talking about CNN reported last week that Bukele's brother, Ibrahim Bukele, said in an email that he wanted the return of seven MS-13 leaders, and that in exchange, he would be able to offer a 50% discount in the price that El Salvador charges to have Venezuelan prisoners and other prisoners deported to Secot by El Salvador. Why is the Bukele government so invested, so interested in having these gang leaders removed when it's them that they let them go? That's the government has accused us, and a lot of the speakers for the government have accused us of collaborating with the gangs, when it's so blatantly obvious that we wouldn't have been able to arrest to interview Charlie if they wouldn't have released him. He was in jail. He was already arrested. He's supposed to be in jail. The only reason that we were able to interview him is that the government released him. And the fact having him on camera is a living proof that Bukele dealt with the gangs. And this goes so much against the narrative that he is, this protector of Salvadoran people, because he has been making secret dealings behind their back, and we're just putting that to light.
Well, we only have 30 seconds, but what has been the response by the people in El Salvador to the revelations of your new site?
El Salvador is in a great state of turmoil now. One of the reasons being this publication, but there's so many problems. I just want to say before I finish that I'm here speaking because there are many others that cannot speak because Alejandro Enriquez, who was arrested last night in El Salvador, cannot speak right now because Roberto Jaco, who died in a prison last night after being arrested in last week after being arrested by the government, can't speak right now because the pastor Angel Perez cannot speak right now. We're
Nelson
telling a story
Radizabla,
and the word should say.
We have to go, but we're going to continue this conversation in Spanish at democracynow.org. Digital editor for El Faro.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.